South Africa's president is scheduled to meet with his Zimbabwean counterpart, Robert Mugabe, for talks on Zimbabwe's political crisis. The meeting comes a week before next week's crucial presidential runoff vote. NPR's Ophelia Quist-Arkton has more from Johannesburg.
President Thabo Mbeki of South Africa has been leading mediation efforts in Zimbabwe, but he has been sharply criticized by some for adopting a cautious diplomatic approach in his dealings with Zimbabwe's President Robert Mugabe that has failed to end the crisis. Meanwhile, echoing a growing chorus of concern, the leader of South Africa's governing ANC party, Jacob Zuma, said he did not expect a free presidential runoff election in Zimbabwe. Mugabe is due to face opposition challenger Morgan Tsvangirai in a vote scheduled next week. But Mugabe's supporters have been accused by the opposition, human rights organizations, and Western governments of a campaign of violence against the opposition. Ophelia Quist-Arkton, NPR News, Johannesburg.
Israel and Hamas have agreed to a ceasefire in the Gaza Strip. It's due to take effect tomorrow. Brokered by Egypt, the truce calls for Hamas to stop firing rockets and mortars at Israel. If the attacks cease, Israel is to ease its year-long blockade of Gaza, allowing more fuel and other supplies into the territory. The sanctions would be fully lifted if Hamas releases a captured Israeli soldier. Afghan and NATO forces are using attack helicopters and warplanes overhead and armored tanks on the ground as they battle Taliban insurgents outside the southern city of Kandahar, trying to drive out militants who've occupied several villages. The Taliban is threatening to mount attacks from the area on Kandahar, Afghanistan's second-largest city. I'm Barbara Klein, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from sitforless.com, selling all colors of the Herman Miller Aeron chair online, including the new color, True Black. Sitforless.com.
Your unwanted car, truck, or boat can stop taking up valuable space in your driveway and help pay for your favorite WILL programs. Donate your unwanted vehicle to WILL through the Car Talk Vehicle Donation Program. To learn more, go to willpledge.org and click on Donate Your Car. Thanks.
WILL programming is made possible by Strawberry Fields Natural Food Store, featuring locally grown and organic produce, freshly baked breads, a coffee bar, and bulk foods department. Strawberry Fields also offers natural vitamins, health and beauty products, household cleaning products, pet foods, and an in-store nutritionist to answer questions about healthy eating.
June means picnics, swimming pools, and lazy summer days. Before you get into the summer mode, remember AM 580 will serve you all summer long with news and analysis of key issues and events of the day. And support from listeners like you helps make it all possible. Please renew your membership or make an additional gift before the fiscal year ends June 30th. If you've received a letter from us, send it back right away, please, or call 1-866-779-9455. Thank you.
It's 7 minutes past 1 o'clock. This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. In this portion of the program, we were scheduled to speak with economist Teresa Ghilarducci, author most recently of When I'm 64, The Plot Against Pensions and the Plan to Save Them. Our guest is unavailable at this time, so we are going to turn to the archives this afternoon, and we will reschedule this interview with economist Teresa Ghilarducci for another day. In the meantime, though, we will turn to the archives, and as this is a recorded interview that was conducted in February of 2007, we won't be taking your calls this afternoon. Thanks. This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at will.uiuc.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for joining us today. Two health policy experts join us today to share their assessment of the state of mental health care and mental health policy in the United States. Richard Frank is a professor of health economics at Harvard. Sherry Gleed is a professor of health policy and management at Columbia. Together, they are the authors of Better But Not Well, Mental Health Policy in the United States Since 1950. The title was inspired by the words of Dr. Gerald Clareman, a psychiatrist who 30 years ago said people with mental illnesses in the U.S. were better but not well. Frank and Gleed say the U.S. has continued to make progress in improving the quality of mental health care, but again, we must strive to do better. They say people disabled by mental illness remain worse off than other groups with illness and disability. And one of the things they suggest is to look at how programs to help the mentally ill are performing and reward quality care. They say with a modest investment, we could see further significant improvement in the quality of life for persons with mental illness. As I mentioned, Richard Frank is at Harvard. He is Morris Professor of Health Economics. He is also a research associate at the National Bureau of Economic Research. Sherry Gleed is a professor and chair of the Department of Health Policy and Management at the Mailman School of Public Health at Columbia. Their book, Better But Not Well, Mental Health Policy in the United States Since 1950, is published by the Johns Hopkins University Press. Professors Frank and Gleed, good afternoon. Welcome. Thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Good afternoon. Good afternoon to you.
I thought we might begin with some basic questions, questions that you take up in the book's second chapter. You note here in the beginning of the second chapter that mental illness is more visible today than it was 50 years ago. Why has it become more visible?
I think there are a couple of factors that have contributed to that. One is that 50 years ago, people with severe mental illness were more likely to be hospitalized in state institutions far away from population centers. So out of sight was very much out of mind. I think a second reason, though, is that we've also come to recognize that a whole bunch of conditions that we might have just thought of as personality quirks or people who are just always unhappy, we now recognize these as being mental health problems that are amenable to mental health treatment. So for both for the severely ill and I think for the less seriously ill, we've had growing recognition and awareness of the existence of mental illness.
So, and here's a couple of related questions then. Have we seen an increase in mental illness or an increase in the diagnosis of mental illness?
We've seen an increase in diagnosis, but most studies, there have been epidemiologic studies that have been conducted over time, so studies where surveyors go out and actually try and assess whether the people they're talking to are experiencing a mental illness. And according to those surveys, there really hasn't been any change in the underlying prevalence of mental illness, but we have become more adept at diagnosing it.
Yeah, and has the definition of mental illness changed over the last five, six decades?
In many ways, it has. I mean, it's a definition that does change from time to time. Certain conditions that we thought of as being mental illness are no longer considered mental illnesses, and on the other hand, we recognize other conditions as being more likely to be mental illnesses. So there has been some change in diagnosis. Probably not much worse with respect to mental illness than most other disorders, though.
Yeah, and has the population with mental illness changed?
The characteristics of the population haven't changed a great deal. We still see mental illness is more prevalent among lower-income people, and that's partly because mental illness causes you to have a lower income. And it's equally split between women and men, although the diagnoses tend to be different.
Yeah. Once upon a time, mental illness was seen as a personal failing or as a possession of demons. Where are we today in terms of the stigma of mental illness?
Well, on the stigma, the people are far more informed about what mental illness is and the degree to which it's amenable to treatment than they were, say, 20, 30, 40 years ago. However, the desire to keep your distance from people with particularly severe mental illnesses has persisted to a surprising degree over time.
Mm. And how does that relate to homelessness and the number of people we see incarcerated with mental illness?
Well, I think that our experience in those areas has really been that conditions that people with mental illness are more likely to be in, such as being homeless or being incarcerated, those populations as a whole have really grown over time. So it's not that people with mental illness are a cause of increased homelessness or a cause of increased incarceration, but that as our society has for a whole bunch of reasons increased the number of homeless people and the number of people incarcerated, a disproportionate burden of that has fallen on people with mental illness.
Mm-hmm. And is that where mental health policy is failing us today?
Well, certainly stigma contributes to the problem, but I don't think that that's the, I mean, that's the levels of incarceration and homelessness are a symptom, but I think that is partly due to stigma, but also due to other failings in the social safety net.
Hmm. You say today a medical approach to mental illness is standard. What does that mean?
Well, I think generally what's meant by that is that the way we deal with mental illness is grounded in the same sort of scientific approach that you see in other medical conditions. So there's been a tremendous amount of advance in our knowledge about the brain and about the origins of some of the mental illnesses and some of the causes. And so the approaches to treatment have now sort of moved along a parallel path to what you see in the rest of medical care.
Is that why we've turned largely to drugs to treat mental illness?
Well, I think that's part of it. While the drugs have received certainly a lot of attention, drugs are not by any means most of the money. Still a lot of money is spent on counseling with psychiatrists and psychologists and other professionals and hospitalizations and other kinds of what you might call psychosocial treatments. So there's still plenty of that going on. But the great increase in spending on drugs is in part due to the fact that there have been sort of some important scientific breakthroughs in those areas.
Mm, okay.
As well, we've seen a huge increase. I think people may not even appreciate it in the amount of psychosocial counseling that is done now. I mean, we've just had this enormous increase in the number of practitioners who are actually providing psychological services in addition to to psychopharmacology. And so there's just been an expansion in treatment across the board, not only in the use of drugs.
Yeah. What is allowed for that?
Well, the major things is that we now have a variety of both public and private insurance programs that, while not always treating mental health equally to all other types of illnesses, certainly has dramatically expanded the amount of insurance protection that people have. So since 1965, we've had Medicare and Medicaid, which offer considerable coverage for mental health. In the case of Medicare, it's not generally on par. And then private insurance has expanded tremendously over the last 30, 40 years. And the vast majority of private insurance covers mental health, although they have some special limits. And in general, drug treatment for psychotropic drugs is equal to that of other medical conditions.
Hmm. And the rise of managed care, what impact has that had on mental health care?
Well, the rise of managed care has been particularly significant for mental health. It has dramatically cut the growth of spending in mental health care, and it's actually also been associated with an increase in the rates of treatment of people who are covered by insurance, partly because when you have managed care, what you usually see is the amount of money that the individual has to pay is reduced for, say, a visit for psychotherapy. So it goes from, say, 50% to $15. And so you generally see more people getting treated under managed care arrangements.
Hmm. And so we have greater access to mental health care today?
Yes, you have much greater access, but you have, in general, somewhat less intensive treatment on average.
Okay.
A little less psychotherapy, a little bit more drugs, and quite a bit less hospitalization.
Yeah. And this access that we have, is it sufficient?
That's a debate. The evidence on managed care is that overall there isn't strong evidence suggesting that it's been bad for the average quality, although there are some subgroups that seem to have been harmed a bit, particularly people with the more severe and complicated disorders.
But I also think that the whole access question has to be tied into questions of the quality of the care that's available. The issue is not really, I mean, there are certainly people who don't have appropriate access to mental health services, and we need to worry about that group. But I also think that we need to be very conscious of the huge variations in the care that people are currently receiving. So we look at how many people are getting care. We also see some improvements in the quality of the care they're receiving, but there are clearly big deficits remaining in terms of the kind of care that people ought to be getting and are getting.
What are those deficits?
To some extent, inappropriate use of psychotherapies, that some psychotherapies are more effective than others, inappropriate dosages and uses of drugs, inappropriate combinations or lack of combinations of drugs and psychotherapy, depending on the condition. So we see some people getting excellent care, but there's a lot of people out there who are not getting the care that they should.
Yeah, and what about the wait for care?
You mean the amount of time between sort of identifying a problem and getting in to see a doctor?
Yeah, right.
I haven't seen reports that that's a huge problem for most people in most parts of the country.
Hmm. One of the other characteristics of the supply of mental health services is that those two are quite variable, and so problems that may exist in one place in the country don't necessarily exist everywhere, and that's also an issue. There are some places that are significantly underserved.
Now, the one area where there tends to be a bit of a problem on this, sort of in a lot of places, is in the area of child psychiatrists. It seems that they're just in very short supply.
Yeah. Well, here fairly recently, maybe a year or so ago, the local newspaper did quite a bit of reporting on this. And in our community, it seems that it can take you quite a bit of time to get in to see someone.
It may also depend on the type of provider. So it's often difficult to get in to see psychiatrists.
Yeah.
And a lot of the questions in mental health policy have had to do with, well, to what extent are psychologists or social workers or counselors appropriate substitutes for psychiatrists? When can you be using a less costly or less skilled option, and when do you need to go to the psychiatrist? And that's actually a question that I think we don't really have very good answers to yet.
I think the other area where this can come up is in public clinics for people who don't have much insurance or have no insurance that are funded primarily by the state, off the state budget. In those cases, you can get some cues that form because it's hard to get in particularly in a low income area.
To what extent are family practitioners involved in providing mental health care?
Well, there's been an enormous increase in the share of mental health care that is being provided by primary care practitioners, family practitioners, all over the country, primarily because of the introduction of new medications that primary care practitioners are much more comfortable prescribing. So we've seen a very large increase in that population.
Yeah, like today, for example, 50% of people treated for depression mm-hmm. are treated by a primary care doctor.
Mm.
And not a specialist.
Yeah. And how does that shake out in terms of quality of care? Is that a good thing, do you think?
There's some evidence that primary care practitioners are occasionally a little bit overly cautious and maybe under using lower dosages than are appropriate for some conditions. But on the whole, I think it really depends on which conditions are being treated by who. And I think one of the changes that we've seen in the recent past has been much more care of people who might never have reached a psychiatrist. Their conditions might never have gotten them all the way to a psychiatrist, and now they're actually getting care. So a lot of it has to do with who's getting care from whom, the matching process.
Yeah. And how ill you are.
How ill you are.
Yeah. What leads to such regional variation? Are there great differences state to state?
Yes, I mean that's true of all of healthcare, and in mental health, you just have lots of things that differ. There is insurance coverage differences. There are cultural differences. There are huge supply differences. and you know, they're just sort of there's just very different histories. So, you know, in New York State, you have an infrastructure for mental health that is, you know, very rich compared to some of the smaller states in the South. And so they're just the traditions, the history, the culture, et cetera, are all extraordinarily different, and they produce very different rates of treatment and levels of spending.
Mm. Our guests this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine are the authors of Better But Not Well, Mental Health Policy in the United States Since 1950. Our guests are Richard Frank. He's a professor of health economics at Harvard. Sherry Gleed is also with us. She is a professor of health policy and management at Columbia. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with your questions and comments. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Let's talk with a listener now, a listener in Urbana on line one. Hi.
Hello. I would like your guest's comment on my situation. I've had a history of depression, and it's been treated quite well with medication for a long time. This is my observation, though. Psychiatrists have been the required practitioner to dispense the medication that I need. And therapists were supposed to do, you know, talk therapy. Mm-hmm. In all the years that I have been involved with this situation of depression, I have gone to psychiatrists in several cities and states, having moved quite a bit. Never once has a psychiatrist checked my blood pressure, even checked to see whether my heart was beating properly. The standard interview is given of, you know, are you sleeping well, and, you know, are you suicidal, and all the rest of that little list.
Right.
And then they prescribe the medications, and that's the end. And charge the highest fee of any, you know, of any of the mental health practitioners. And my question is, has this been the experience in your research? Is this what, you know, psychiatrists tend to do? Is that the kind of care that is given at the highest rates of fees? I'd really just like to know your feedback. And I'll hang up and listen on the radio. Thank you.
Okay.
The history of this is hopefully a little bit informative to you. In the 60s, when the community mental health movement really started moving patients into the community and emphasized the community treatment, the major mental health clinics, known as community mental health centers, had a requirement to give everybody who came in for mental health treatment a physical. And that persisted probably till the early 70s. And then at that point, it seemed to fade away. And I think that over time, there's been sort of waves of this that have come and gone. And, you know, it's pretty heterogeneous, but it's probably, to a large extent, unfortunate that there isn't more tendency to give physicals unless there's sort of some very important clue that you need some kind of physical treatment. But it is an ongoing problem generally, the physical care of people with mental illnesses.
And it's an increasing problem because some of the new psychotropic medications seem to have some side effects that are related to physical health. So in that respect, I think it's actually a very significant problem to be addressing. Part of the reason for it is also that psychiatrists have not worked with primary care practitioners in the same way that I think some other specialists have in terms of the way the referral patterns work. So people may be under the care of a psychiatrist without actually getting their physicals done by their primary care doctor either. So the system, the fragmentation of the system has also been a bit of an issue there.
Yeah. What should be done to fix that fragmentation problem?
Well, I think, you know, certainly one is that I think the professional society ought to, you know, make it known that this is considered good care, and so should the quality accrediting agencies, that there should be sort of attention to these things, particularly with, Dr. Gleed pointed out, cases where particularly some of the antipsychotic medications aren't linked to things like obesity, diabetes, high cholesterol, and things like that.
Mm. Are persons with mental illness playing a larger role, having a larger say in the course of their treatment, how they will be treated?
Definitely, both at, I think at the individual level and at the policy level, one of the things that has really changed over the past 50 years is the role of people with mental illness in thinking through these issues, in playing a part in these dimensions of care and of policy. So we've seen the rise of mental health advocacy in a big way, and the whole consumer movement in which patients with mental illness really see themselves as the centerpiece of care. So now we see a movement towards recovery, where, again, one that's really very much driven by people with mental illness themselves.
Now, how do mental health patient advocacy groups assess the state of mental health care policy today?
In fact, one of the things that motivated our book is that there is, in general, in the mental health field, both among patients and among providers, a certain pessimism. And I think that, there's a tendency for both sides to be somewhat pessimistic about the state of affairs. But I do think that the fact that they have developed such a strong voice has also energized them, even if they're somewhat pessimistic about sort of how well things are going. It's given them the hope that they can do something about it. And so I think that the advocacy has sort of created energy and a sort of a positive outlook in some sense, even if when you talk to advocacy groups about the state of mental health care in America today, they're somewhat pessimistic.
Yeah. What's on their wish lists?
I think all advocates, reasonably enough, look for the things that need to be fixed, and there are certainly plenty of things that still need to be fixed in mental health. One of them, I think, is more community support for people with serious mental illness, supportive housing, for example, which we know is tremendously effective in improving the well-being of people with mental illness and even the communities around them. And funding for that is very limited, so we need to do more on that front. Making it easier for people with mental illness to remain in the workforce or to return to the workforce, another big issue.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guests this afternoon, Sherry Gleed and Richard Frank. Richard Frank is a professor of health economics at Harvard. Sherry Gleed, professor of health policy management at Columbia. Together, they are the authors of Better But Not Well, Mental Health Policy in the United States Since 1950. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. When did we begin to see the rise of patient advocacy groups for mental health care and mental health care policy?
There's sort of the historians will tell you that it goes way back, actually, to probably the 50s. But I think that as a political force, you really saw the mental health advocacy movement coming to life in the 70s and the 80s.
Let's take another call. Listener in Urbana on line one. Hi.
Thank you for this program. Being a big believer in holistic care, I'm very much involved, was involved with that. My question is, what role does fear play? Because I really haven't read this book, but I'm really interested because I myself am on an antidepressant. I'll hang up and listen to your answer off the air.
Well, could I ask the listener a question? Yes. In terms of fear, what do you mean fear is part of the...
Rejection.
Rejection.
Yeah.
In terms of
people putting up, like in football, their arms, they keep you at a distance.
Okay.
Anyhow, do you need any more explanation?
I think we've got something to work with there. Do their guests want to comment?
I think that certainly stigma kind of keeps people out of treatment, gets them to particular treatment combinations that may or may not be best for them because they're trying to, in a sense, hide their illnesses. And then I think that it keeps people from using their insurance and things like that because they don't want they're concerned that employers are going to find out and that will affect their job status. Whether, in fact, that's true or not, I think there is at least some evidence that that's the perception out there.
Oh. Sherry, did you want to comment?
I also think that the rise of mental health drugs that can be administered in general practice has been a bit of a boon in terms of the fear factor, because I think many people who would be quite uncomfortable going to see a specialized mental health practitioner are willing to accept an antidepressant, for example, when it's prescribed by their primary care practitioner. So that may be part of the reason also that we've seen a big uptick in outpatient treatment.
Yeah. Here maybe it's time to introduce a couple of terms involving mental health policy that you use throughout the book, exceptionalism and mainstreaming. What is exceptionalism?
Well, exceptionalism is kind of a reflection of the fact that there have been for many, many years, decades, special institutions set up to sort of focus on, say, people with mental illnesses. So, for example, in the 50s and before that, you had state mental hospitals, and you had separate mental health agencies in state government, and very often you had a unique set of benefits under insurance for mental health that were separated and managed differently because the circumstances of mental illness were viewed as exceptional.
And why did we move away from this particular way of viewing mental health care? Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Right. To some extent, it was unintentional. I think to some extent what happened is that we built up a network of social programs for people not with mental illness, but just for people who were poor, disadvantaged in a variety of ways. And those programs have gradually siphoned off a lot of people with mental illness and funding for mental illness. So a lot of mental care for people with mental health problems and mental illness has been mainstreamed, has been moved out of these exceptional institutions and into institutions and organizations that serve not only people with mental illness, but also people with other conditions or people who are low income for other reasons.
And what role has the way we pay for mental health care played in the change?
A very big part of that mainstreaming was the Medicaid program. That has probably been the most important of the mainstream programs in terms of moving people out of specialized exceptional institutions and into standard community-based practice. The Medicaid program, well, you know what, I'm going to defer to Richard on this one. Dr. Frank.
Yeah, well, no, I totally agree with that. I would say the Medicaid program and Social Security, Supplemental Security Income, and the Disability Insurance Program have been the other two pieces that have just been incredibly important because starting in the early 70s, not only did you have sort of health insurance that actually did a very good job covering sort of the best mental health treatments of the day, but and the drugs, but you also had a source of income support for very sick people that enabled them to live in the community, albeit at a very low level. But nevertheless, there was a source of income that would get people into sort of the American mainstream to some extent.
Hmm. What are the downsides of mainstreaming?
Some of the problems that people with mental illness have are, in fact, unique to people with mental illness. And in particular, in many cases, the involvement with many of these service systems is a particular feature of people with mental illness. The need for supportive housing, some other services that are really most important to this population. That has been, I think, a little bit fallen by the wayside. And even more important than that, I think, when mental illness is really under the control of the state mental health authorities in each state, advocates, patients, families, people knew who was accountable for the well-being of people with mental illness. Now that a variety of programs that serve lots of people are the ones who actually pay for and provide these services, it's a lot harder to look at the global picture and see where the problems are and know who should be addressing them.
Outside of funding for housing, what other kinds of services are most important for this population?
Well, certainly income support is important. Supported employment is another. If you go to the people who are on Social Security disability programs and you ask them about their interest in working, they all claim to be very interested in working, and there's great desire to work. Yet it's very difficult to make all that happen. In part because our ability to get people to the level of functioning where large numbers of them can work is still quite uncertain, but also just because there are difficulties in arranging for the types of supports that these people need in order to successfully integrate into the workforce.
Yeah. Is part of the problem here also fragmentation? That everything is kind of scattered here and there, and you've got to go and
negotiate the system.
Yeah.
That certainly doesn't help. But even when there's coordination out there, it's still a pretty serious challenge.
Yeah. Well, if we've seen an improvement in access, and we have private insurance, Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, income support, why do we have people falling through the cracks?
I think in part that is the fragmentation problem. Mm. That is the problem of trying to have somebody focused on this particular population. Mental illnesses can be particularly debilitating in terms of even making it very difficult for people to fill out the forms and get enrolled in these programs. Proving disability can be more difficult for people with mental illness. So there are plenty of, the cracks in the system. Our social safety net generally is full of cracks, and they're particularly difficult to negotiate for people with serious mental illnesses.
So how should we go about sewing up the holes?
Well, I do think that what needs to happen is, there's sort of two approaches. One approach is to say, well, let's go back to exceptionalism and really kind of try to make things mental health specific so that we recognize all those needs. That's not where we sort of come down. I think that we've sort of been leaning towards the idea that what you want to do is bring mental health expertise to all these social programs and to then have government have a role in state and federal government that sort of looks after the big picture. What are we doing for people with mental illnesses that rely on the whole host of programs that are offered, ranging from housing to employment support, to income maintenance, to treatment. And it's really, in a sense, bringing the mental health expertise to the mainstream programs that we think is likely to allow us to continue to hold on to the gains that have been made, and then hopefully start to fill in some of the holes.
Yeah. I think it's important to remember that the exceptionalism system had holes too, and it also had significant deficiencies from the perspective of people with mental illness. It required them to give up much more than was necessary or desirable, and it put them often in very poor conditions and with very little control over their own destinies. So it would really be a mistake to say that fragmentation means that we should just
go back
to the mainstream altogether. Yeah. It's a matter of trying to build from the mainstream and make the mainstream more responsive to the needs of people with mental illness.
Yeah. What do you think the likelihood is to hold on to gains and to continue to get better?
Well, I think there are certainly things that should make you nervous. Some of the concerns about cutting Medicaid certainly mm-hmm. is something that the mental health advocacy community ought to be paying attention to, although even there, for example, some of the recent proposals that came out of the administration's Medicaid commission, on one hand, sort of suggest some cutbacks that would be meaningful to, you know, potentially harmful to people with mental illnesses. On the other hand, they suggested sort of some increased flexibility to kind of give people new opportunities for community-based treatments that are actually very helpful. And so I think that, you know, the idea is to sort of make sure that you know, the key things that people with mental illnesses rely on kind of stay in place, and, you know, reasonable, you know, cost savings that are reasonable still be made.
Let's talk with another listener. Caller in Kankakee on line 4. Hi.
Thomas Shaws, the author of The Myth of Mental Illness, viewed mental illness as just that, a myth. Are the guests familiar with his work? Could they comment on it? And what do they think of the idea that behavioral problems and disabilities in thought are often not disease problems at all? Thank you.
Okay.
We talk about this a little bit in the book, and I think it is possible to over-medicalize things. I don't want to deny the significance of that approach, but I think one of the things that we've seen is that people make real gains in their lives and report being much more satisfied and much happier with appropriate mental health treatment. And I'm uncomfortable saying that that improvement in life satisfaction is somehow an undesirable thing.
Yeah, I mean, certainly, just, you know, I think that's, you know, that's absolutely right. And I think that, you know, personally, when you go out and see people who have severe mental illnesses and then see what happens to them when they get treated, and, you know, you look a little bit at the research on the science of the brain, you know, it's hard not to be impressed that there's something real, there's something going on here that's a lot like illnesses everywhere else.
And another caller. Let's take this call next. Listener in Urbana on line 1. Hi.
Hello?
Hello.
Yes, I'm calling to see what legal rights under federal and state laws. I'm thinking about federal, Federal Mental Health Parity Act, I believe, of 1996 or 7. And I believe Senator Domenici of New Mexico, who has a relative that suffered is suffering a severe disabling mental illness, is trying to get that strengthened. To what degree do these laws, federal and state, equalize treatment for mental illness with physical illness? And are they effective? Or do we still have a great disparity between what actually happens in the marketplace concerning mental treatment as opposed to treatment for, quote, physical ailments?
Yeah, I think the so-called parity laws that I think you're referring to actually do help, but I don't think they help as much as the advocates think they're going to help. For a couple reasons. The main reason is that, as we've been discussing, managed care has been very important in this market in controlling cost and utilization. And so what parity does is it makes the terms under which you're covered more generous, but it doesn't mean that you'll get anything that you want or anything that your provider necessarily things you might need. Instead, there's a sort of a process that the managed care companies go through in conjunction with the providers that may limit care, even though it's better reimbursed. But the federal government took up parity a number of years ago, and the results from that suggest that the sickest people wind up taking much less of a financial hit when they get very sick and need treatment for a mental disorder with the parity law than they did before. And so in a lot of ways, it's doing exactly what you'd hope to it would do, which is it really protects people when they get really sick. But it comes at the cost of sort of perhaps not giving some less sick people as much intensive treatment as they'd like.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks for the question. You argue, as I mentioned in my introduction, for rewarding quality care. What does that mean? How would that work?
As we said earlier, there are these significant variations in the quality of care that is being delivered for mental health right now. And throughout the healthcare system, we're seeing a movement towards recognizing that quality differs among practitioners and in different situations, and trying to reward those providers who are really performing well. And we think that that's a movement that really should be thought about very seriously in mental health care.
Yeah, for particularly in the public sector, for many, many years, the way we paid for and rewarded particularly publicly funded clinics was through historical contracts that community mental health centers would be working under a grant or a contract that they'd been holding since the 1960s. And there was very little oversight given to exactly what was going on in terms of the quality and the content of care. And now that's beginning to change. And the payers are becoming much more interested in getting documentation on what's going on and on making sure that they're getting value for their dollars.
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about how quality care is assessed?
There are fairly well-developed guidelines about how care ought to be delivered for many mental health conditions. We actually have done, there has been an enormous amount of scientific research sort of assessing what is good quality mental health care. So it's possible to look, first of all, at the processes of care to see how people are doing. And then in certain circumstances, it's even possible to look at some of the outcomes of care and see whether people are actually getting better or able to achieve the things that you'd like them to.
In summary, anything the two of you would like to say?
Well, I think, you know, one of the things that I think we've come away with is that, you know, through this process of mainstreaming, which, as Dr. Glee pointed out, in part came about through happenstance, you know, was not planned, the fortunes of people with mental illnesses have really improved. And we've walked away with the notion that, you know, and sometimes when you throw money at a problem, it actually helps, and it helps a lot. And I think that this is one of those cases.
Very good. There we will leave it. Richard Frank, Sherry Gleed, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Sherry Gleed and Richard Frank are the authors of Better But Not Well, Mental Health Policy in the United States Since 1950. The book is published by the Johns Hopkins University Press. And that interview was conducted on February 23rd of 2007. The interview we had scheduled for today with economist Teresa Gilarducci will be rescheduled. We were to talk with her about retirement and retirement reform. She is the author most recently of When I'm 64, The Plot Against Pensions and the Plan to Save Them. Again, we'll reschedule that interview. It is 1:53 Central Time. Settlement prices are in from Kansas City and Chicago. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thank you very much. Let's take a look at the numbers as they settled in Chicago in the wheat pit today. July contract, a 9.13.5 high for the day, range down to a low of $8.85 for that nearby, and a settlement price up 5.75 cents at $9.04. September 9.31, the high, the low at 9.03. September soft red winter wheat settled at $9.22, up 5.75. And December futures, 9.54, the high, the low at 9.26.25, a settlement price up 6 cents at 9.45.5. March futures at 9.75, top, bottom at 49.25. Their settlement price up $9.67, or up at 9.67, up 6 cents for the day. And Kansas City, nearby July contract, settled 6.25 higher at 9.45.25. And the December spring wheat settled at $10.13.75, up 7.75 from the corn pit in Chicago. The nearby gained 4 cents. The top for the July futures at 7.55. The bottom at 7.32 and three quarters. A settlement price at 746 and a quarter, up 4. September futures 768, the high, the low at 46 and three quarters. Settlement price at $7.60 and a quarter, up 3 3/4. And December corn 788, the high, the low at 766 and a quarter. Settlement price at $7.80, up 4 cents. March futures 801 and three quarters, the high, the low at 780 and three quarters. Settlement price there up 4 1/4 at 794 and a quarter. In the May contract in the corn pit, 807, the top, the bottom at 789 and a quarter. A settlement price at $8, up 4 cents for the afternoon. December futures for 2009, 687 and a quarter, the high, the low at $6.72. The 09 corn, $6.85 for the December futures, up 4.5 cents. July oat futures, 427. A settlement price there up 3 cents, 435 the top, the bottom at 17 and a quarter. September oats, 442 and a quarter, the high, the low at 430 and a quarter, settled at $4.38 and a half. Up 2 cents a bushel. July soybean futures down 2 cents today. $15.73 and a quarter, the high, the low at $15.39 and a quarter. The lead option beans lost 2 cents to settle at $15.56 a bushel. August contract $15.76 and a half, the high, the low at $15.44. Settlement price $15.61, down a penny and 3/4. In September, $15.63 and 3/4, the high, the low at $15.32 and a half. Settlement price at $15.45 and a half, down 6.5 cents. November soybeans $15.66 and 3/4, the high, the low at $15.28. Settlement price at $15.43, a dime lower for the November. January futures lost 10.5 cents today, $15.78 and a quarter, the high, the low at $15.42 and 3/4, and a settlement price for the January beans $15.55 and 3/4 of a cent. Down 10.5 cents a bushel. November 2009 soybeans $14.81 the top, and the bottom at $14.50 and a half, and a settlement price up 3 cents today at $14.70. July bean meal $4.1940 the high, the low at $4.1190. Settlement price at $417.10 a ton, up $2.10. August futures were up $1.10 at $415.10 a ton. July bean oil $66.40 the high, the low at $64.41. Settlement price down 34 at $65.46. And the August bean oil $66.70 the high, the low at $64.75. Settlement price 35 cents lower at $65.80. That's a look at the numbers from the Chicago Board of Trade. In a moment, the numbers from the CME Group's Mercantile Exchange side and the livestock. Don't forget to stay with us this afternoon in just about 10 minutes during the closing market report. We'll talk with Paul Cooley of ADM Investor Services in Oakland, Illinois. He joins us here each and every Wednesday to discuss the agricultural futures markets. I'm Todd Gleason.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
And now let's take a look at what happened today at the Merck in Chicago. It looks like it was a higher day today in Chicago. June live cattle, the high 96.30, the low 95.50, the settlement 96.12.5, that down 20. August 103.95, the high 103, even the low, the settlement 103.90, that up 30. October 111.82.5, the high 110.70, the low, the settlement 111.77.5, that up 55. December 113.70, the high 112.65, the low 113.67.5, the settlement, that up 72.5. August feeder cattle 110.80, the high 109.80, the low 110.50, the settlement, that up 17.5. September 113, the high 111.90, the low 112.87.5, the settlement, that up 25. October 114, the high 112.70, the low, the settlement 113.95, that up 77.5. November 114.30, the high 112.92.5, the low, the settlement 114.30. So November feeder cattle finished up 80 cents on the day. July lean hog 75.10, the high 74.50, the low 74.85, the settlement, that up 22.5. August 76.50, the high 75.65, the low, the settlement 76.07.5, that down 7.5. October 75.25, the high 74.70, the low, the settlement 75.17.5, that up 20. December lean hog, 77.50. The high, the low, 77 even. The settlement, 77.10. That down 10. And July pork bellies, 72.75. The high, the low, 70.65. Finishing at 72.60. Down 12.5. The Dow off 104 points at 12,056. The NASDAQ is off 24 at 24.34. And the S&P 500 down 11 points at 13.40. You're tuned to WILL Urbana, the broadcasting service of the College of Media at Illinois. It's 1 minute before 2 o'clock. I'm Celeste Quinn. The producer for the afternoon magazine is Harriet Williamson. Our technical director today is Henry Frain. In the WILL severe weather coverage area, flood warning for Clark County continues until 9:15 tomorrow morning. Law enforcement officials in that area of the state report that although waters were continuing to slowly recede, areas of flooding were continuing across the warned area, and a few roads were still closed. Ed Kieser's forecast for Illinois and Indiana this afternoon, partly to mostly sunny with a chance of a few widely scattered showers and thunderstorms popping up. Highs ranging from 68 in northeastern Indiana.